Hello everyone, this is Ashish. Welcome back to our podcast. Today we are having with us Ricky Palladino. Ricky has been practicing law for a long time, has done it for decades. Since 2012, he has been running his own firm. He's basically an immigration lawyer. Ricky, is that correct? I'm not very technically learned in that field, so I might be making some mistakes. But would you like to explain a little, like what you really do?
Oh, I think you said it perfectly. I am an immigration lawyer in that my practice is limited to helping immigrants throughout the world navigate the rather complex immigration system in the United States. So even though I'm a licensed attorney and able to really practice in any area of the law, I've chosen to only practice in immigration law. And to be quite frank with you, I don't know much about anything outside immigration law, because that's the only thing that I do.
When you say anything, you mean anything in the law field?
Anything in the law. I have a basic understanding of things in the law because I, you know, often help my clients navigate other issues outside of immigration and, of course, pass the bar exam and went to law school. But in my practice, in my professional career, I've done nothing other than immigration law.
That's actually a good thing because you specialize in a particular domain. And that domain itself is very interesting to me because America as a country is made by immigrants. And what you deal with is immigrants on the day-to-day basis. So after dealing with it for decades, what mindset have you created or what idea of the whole American immigration system have you created? What can you say about that? What you think about that? Like how people come from different countries and make a life over here and in turn make this country?
Yeah, so I've got an interesting background in the sense that I was lucky enough to work for the government before getting into the private bar. And I worked for an organization that doesn't exist anymore called the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And I worked there before September 11th, and I actually worked there on September 11th and even shortly after September 11th. So I got to see the immigration system through, or I've been lucky to see it through two different sides, right? The governmental side and then the side on the private bar where I'm helping individuals and companies navigate the immigration system. I've also, through the passage of time, been able to see immigration through, you know, different administrations and different political climates, right? It was very different before September 11th than it was directly after September 11th, and then changed dramatically under President Obama, changed under President Trump, and has even changed under President Biden. So the one thing that I'm certain of is that I am now, in representing individuals that are seeking immigration benefits, on the right side of this. In the sense that, you know, I've been lucky to look at it from all of these different perspectives. And the one thing that is absolutely true is, like you said, Ashish, America is made up of immigrants. That's a fact. Number two is that America needs immigrants. And number three is even taking it a step further, which is that America cannot function as America without immigrants, right? So I always feel that I'm on the right side of this, if there is two sides of it. And of course, there is another side, right? The people that think that immigrants are bad for America, that they're bringing cultures that are not American, and that they're, of course, stealing jobs from Americans. Both of those things I don't agree with. So when I look to help someone navigate the complex immigration system in the United States, I'm looking at it from that perspective that if this person gets through, it's a win for America. It's a win for myself and my children and the world that they're going to inherit. And I also look at it from the standpoint of having a tremendous amount of pride and respect for the United States, because there's a reason why everybody wants to come here, right? This is the greatest country in the world, in my opinion. Certainly, it's got its flaws and it's got its warts, but I certainly understand why people want a better life here in the United States. So I guess that's the framework to your question in terms of what do I think about people that are coming to the United States. I think I would do the same thing if I were them. And I think they deserve an opportunity to be here. And I think that the United States should give folks that opportunity more and easier than we do now, because I think we all benefit and America becomes more, America becomes better and more powerful and greater with immigrants being part of the equation.
You said something that kind of raised a question. You said that America cannot function without immigrants. Is that true? And why would you say that?
From my perspective, it's absolutely true. I have had the benefit of probably meeting, tens of thousands of immigrants in the period of time that I've been doing immigration law, so roughly about 20 years. And I can't recall an immigrant who voluntarily did not have a job in the United States. And what I mean by voluntarily is certainly there's some folks that cannot work because of their physical or mental condition, or folks that cannot work because of their age. But just about every immigrant that I've ever met that wanted a job had a job. So what does that tell you? It tells you that there is work that is absolutely positively out there that needs to be done by someone. And many of the immigrant clients that I've represented are willing and able and happy to do those jobs. That's why I think America cannot function without immigrants. It's also true when you look at it from the perspective of the corporations and the institutions that are bringing people into the United States to work. So think about this for a second. Let's say you own a business, right? You're a US citizen, you own a business, and you have 500 employees, right? And you're faced with a situation where you could hire an American worker, okay? And if you wanted to hire that American worker, you could hire them and have them start working for you in a number of hours, right? You do an on intake process, you have them fill out an I-9, and then boom, you put them on payroll and they're working for you. If you want to hire a foreign national, right, it's going to take you several years likely for that person to be able to work for you in a permanent context where you don't have to worry about the possibility that they won't work with you. And it's going to cost you tens of thousands of dollars, right? So if you're an American employee and you have the choice between these two, it's unreasonable to think that someone's preference wouldn't be for the American citizen purely because it's easy and it's more expeditious, right? However, what we see is thousands, tens of thousands of employers that are looking to sponsor foreign nationals every single day. So why is that, right? Why would someone go to that journey, to that expense, unless it was absolutely necessary? So they're the two kind of spheres that I look at it through, and make it very clear to me that America cannot function without immigrants.
That is always surprising to me as well that international students are, I mean, yeah, sure. What I've seen is that American citizens get more options because there are smaller companies that just cannot go to that distance. But yeah, a lot of international students are getting jobs over here. And I always wonder, like, why is a company ready to pay that much and go to that distance? But we still did not get, like, why do you think that is? What is there in people who are coming from other countries that American citizens cannot be doing on their own? Is it just a number game? Because America is a large country when it comes to numbers as well. A lot of people don't notice this, that it is actually fourth largest country when it comes to numbers. So
Well, I
what
think
is
it's
it
two things. I
really?
think that a part of it is numbers, right? Again, this is not a scientific conclusion on my part. I can't give you the overall population and the population of immigrants in the United States and the number of jobs to tell you that the need is there. I'm concluding that on an anecdotal basis, just based on what I've seen, right? In that, it's there are many, many, many employers out there that simply cannot find work. And that goes from what's called unskilled labor all the way to the highest skilled labor, right? So part of it is me deducing that it is a numbers game. But I think the other part of it is that even if we were to look at the numbers and we were to say that, there was a certain number of able-bodied Americans that could do work, one of the things that changes the game is that America has a very good, in comparison, social welfare system. America has a system that is built on workers' rights, and that carries benefits. So there are many, many people in the United States who are of working age that have chosen some voluntary, some involuntary, to be on the social welfare system. There are many, many people who cannot work because of physical and mental disabilities and are taking social security benefits and things along those lines. So while those people, if you look at it statistically, are able to work, they cannot work either because they've chosen not to or they're in a position where they cannot work. And therein lies the need for immigrant labor, or one of the needs, I should say, for immigrant labor. So that's a part of it. I think the other part of it is that America has been lacking in certain areas. And that would be in the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, to where foreign nationals are educated in a way to where they can come in and start working for an employer on day one, whereas to train an American worker or to pay for their education makes that just as much of an investment of time and money as it is for the visa process. So I think it's all of those three things together create the need, or I should say the demand for immigrants to be in the United States and to work, and what we hope is to become legalized as a result of that.
Right. That is the thing with the third world countries or the developing countries. They are always very focused towards STEM. I remember when I was 18, I was told of only two careers, either engineering or medical. If you study biology, you go for medical, otherwise you go engineering. That's it.
And we don't have that here. It would this the opposite is true in the United States, where again, and it's been some time since I looked at the numbers, but many students graduating colleges in the United States are focused on a different type of education, right? A liberal arts education, which brings in some science, some technology, but it brings in, history and literature and all kinds of different things that don't have a specific practical implication or effect, the same way studying biology leads you to a certain career. And that certainly then creates a demand for the jobs that need science, technology, engineering, and mathematics backgrounds if United States citizens going through traditional college and university aren't getting that. So I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of where people from developing countries and other countries have figured out a way to scratch the itch, right? They figured out a way to become the solution to one of the labor problems that exists in the United
I think
States.
what they're trying to do is be at least the solution for their own countries, because if a country is developing, it will be requiring more STEM majors. But what I was thinking of is that United States of America has always been known as the industrial giant during the World War One, during the World War Two. So you think about a gigantic industry in this country, and the number of STEM majors is not as much. So it automatically, yeah, I think that would finally answer what you said, is that it cannot function without immigrants.
Simply cannot function. Yeah, it's not even a close call for me, right? There's been times, especially between 2016 and 2020, when Donald Trump was president, when the immigration system was being weaponized, and we saw a historic number of arrests, a historic number of denials on green card applications and visa applications. And during that time, I often thought and often wanted to advocate for something along the lines of an immigrant sit-out day, right? Where anyone who was not a lawful permanent resident or not a US citizen would simply just not show up to work for a day, right? And what that would do is it would make society realize how important immigrant labor is to the United States, right? So for and you can do it along the spectrum of work. You go to your favorite restaurant, and if there's not immigrants cooking in the kitchen, if there's not immigrants that are working to provide the food that the kitchen gets, then you're not going to be able to get a meal at your favorite restaurant, all the way up until if your parent is having a surgery and the surgeon is a foreign national and has taken off that day as a way to as a political protest, then you would really see the implication because you would have to reschedule, the surgery for your parent. So I've often thought that that may be, an interesting way to send the message to the rest of society in the hope that Congress would get the memo and do something about immigration reform. But in thinking that out and talking about that with some people, the danger is that many foreign nationals or immigrants would be scared to do that, because in doing so, they would be putting a spotlight on their immigration status, which could have ramifications in the future. So you'd be hard pressed to get the majority of people to agree to do that. But I'll tell you what, if we could find a way to do that, I think it would create changes literally overnight.
Yeah, but a lot of times what happens is that I can relate, because in the whole University of California system, about 3-4 months ago, there was a strike by graduate students who were saying that they are not being paid enough. And to a huge extent, they're not. Like, they're left with just $400 or $500 to deal with their living expenditures. So they went for a strike. But a lot of graduate students who were doing their PhDs did not go for a strike, because that would ruin their relationship with their advisor, under whom they were doing their project. So they're already walking on a very thin thread that they're barely getting by. And I was very happy to see, like, the Americans taking charge, because they do not have to worry about anything like that. And they would just take charge. But that might be a problem, because a lot of them are dependent on this for their living. And but that's what ultimately strikes are always, right? There's nobody sitting comfortably who would be needing to go for a strike, right? But sometimes
I'm of the opinion that in order to get comprehensive immigration reform done, something drastic is going to need to happen, right? Because as long as I've been in immigration law, I started in the year 2000, we saw some changes immediately after that, after September 11th happened. But since then, there have been tens of thousands of proposals to change immigration law. And really, none of them have even gotten close to being passed. The closest one, I think, was under President Bush, where we were close to immigration reform. And to be honest with you, Ashish, I think we're further away from the possibility of immigration reform passing than we've ever been before. And it's because, you know, our country is so divided, Congress is so divided, and immigration has become a partisan issue. One of the reasons I mentioned that we almost saw immigration reform under President Bush is, even though President Bush was in power during 9/11, he was a Republican. At that time, you know, immigration reform wasn't necessarily a bipartisan issue. It was more of a geographical issue. And the opinions varied depending on what part of the country you were in. Obviously, the immigration discussion is very different if you're in Nebraska than it is if you're in California, right, or Texas or New York City. But that's changed, and it's become a political issue, and a political issue that is, you know, so significant that it's hard to envision someone voting based on what they, you know, Republican, for example, voting on what they think is best for America, when it may not be good for their party or for their own political aspirations. So I'm of the opinion that we're going to have to see something drastic happen in order for there to be immigration reform. And we certainly absolutely need immigration reform. And I have not been able to come up with anything that would make that happen other than this this sit out day, which others have talked about as well. But I'm certainly open to hearing what others have to say in terms of how to make it happen. And I certainly hope that it does happen, immigration reform, but I just don't see it in the near future.
When you say immigration reforms, what reforms are you talking about? Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. So there are estimates that there are 12 to 15 million people living in the United States that don't have legal status. Okay, now that would be individuals who came to the United States by crossing the border, right? People coming from Canada or coming from Mexico. That would be individuals who came to the United States with a visa and overstayed their visa, right? There's a whole other class, millions of people who are on visas, but intend and want to become green card holders of the United States. So we're roughly talking about 18 million people that are already here, right? That are already using, you know, our roads, already using the hospitals, already using, you know, public water. Those folks are already here. for the majority of those people, there is not going to be an easy way for them to become legalized. It's very, very hard to get a green card in the United States. You have to fit within certain boxes because we don't have a merit-based system, right? So we don't take someone who says, hey, listen, I'm here and I want a green card. I desire a life in the United States. We don't look at their education, their skill set, their work history, their family ties. We don't look at any of that. We look to see if they fit within certain boxes, right? And if you're someone who came to the United States by crossing the border, or you're someone that came with a visa and you overstayed the visa, the number of options that you have become very, very, very small, right? And one of them is marriage to a U.S. citizen, right? Mm-hmm. So then what happens? Because marriage to a U.S. citizen is one of the few ways that a person can become legalized when they overstay a visa, it creates this market for fake marriages.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the system that we have right now. Mm. And it's a ridiculous system. What's also ridiculous about it is that if you're looking at it from the government standpoint, right, and you say, oh, you know, or you're looking at it from a conservative standpoint, or Republican standpoint, I should say, and say, we don't want these people here. They're taking our jobs. They're bad for society. Well, the system is also so screwed up and so overworked and so overfunded that it takes years upon years to even deport someone, right? Even people, there are people going through our court system where there's allegations against those folks that they've supported a terrorist organization, and it will take those people 4 years in order to get a hearing. Now, again, if you're looking at it from the other standpoint, you would want a system that is going to make this person get a fast hearing so that if they're guilty of terrorism, that we can move them out of the United States. We don't have any of that because we have such a broken system. It's broken for the people that are looking to become legalized. It's also broken for the people that are looking for a way to get immigrants out of the country that don't deserve to be here. So that's what I mean when I say that the system is broken. Comprehensive immigration reform means that we're going to take the system of laws that we have right now, most of which were written in 1996 and then changed a little bit over the years, that we're going to take that system and blow it up. We're going to blow it up and we're going to create another system, a system that is first focused on what do we do with the 18 million people that are already here? How can we find a way to get those people to be legalized? Number one, because they deserve it. It's a human rights issue. And number two, because society in general will benefit. One of the things that was done under the last amnesty is there was a requirement that each person pay a penalty fee of $1,000. Now, I can tell you every single one of my clients would pay that $1,000 penalty fee in a second. As a matter of fact, course. You could double it, make it 2,000. You could even triple it. They would pay it in a second.
They pay a lot more to cross the border because I know the numbers that goes that they pay to their agents and all.
So people would pay that. Yeah. And you'd find a way to bring more money into America, into the tax system. You'd be having people, I mean, think about it. When someone's here and they're undocumented, they don't have a driver's license. But let's not kid ourselves that these people are going to need to drive, right? Because they're going to need to work. Would you rather have the people on your roads licensed and insured or unlicensed, right? There's a reason why we have driver's licenses, because you have to pass a basic test. You have to understand, you know, the basic rules of the road. We should want people to become licensed. So that's what comprehensive immigration reform is. It's looking at what we have and saying it's broken. It doesn't work. It will never work. And maybe even one step further, it is actually holding us back as a nation in terms of developing, you know, many different things in developing a better economy, a better labor force, more cultural awareness. I mean, everything all the way down to having safer roads because people have driver's licenses.
Right. When you were saying that millions of people are living over here, and obviously if they're living, they're working over here, I was thinking that you were getting towards like they're not paying taxes because they're not legally working over here. And also what I think is that they are not safe because if they do not have a proper identity and some crime goes against them, then how are they going to deal with it? I don't really know how they How they work out with the health insurance? Can they get
So
health insurance?
there's a couple different classifications, if you will, of people that are working in the United States that are immigrants. And again, we're not talking about people that have green cards. People that have visas to the United States or that have work permits, and generally someone has a work permit when they have a case that's in progress, most of those individuals have a social security number. So they're working legally with a social security number. And because of that number, and because the work is authorized, they can get insurance. So they are certainly more protected than the next classification of people. The next classification of people are people who are just working for cash or working under the table. Those folks, you're absolutely right, certainly can be taken advantage of. They're frequently taken advantage of. And they're left to only be able to advance their careers to the extent that it's a job that doesn't, or it's an employer who doesn't require them to have a social security number. There's a third classification of people, and this might blow your mind. These are individuals who really are no different than the second classification, except that they went through a process with the Internal Revenue Service, with the IRS, in order to get a document called a tax identification number. A tax identification number looks like a social security number. Same number of digits, same set of digits, and that
dashes and all.
You know, you get three digits, dash, two digits, and then so looks very, very similar to that, but it's not a social security number because it's not issued by the Social Security Administration and it doesn't carry any social security benefits. So you say to yourself, well, what is the purpose of that number? Why would the IRS give it to someone? And they give it to foreign nationals for the purpose of giving them an identity number that can't get social security numbers. So the IRS can't be stupid. They have to know what that number is being utilized for. And it's a way for people who are working here illegally in many circumstances, but not all, to have a number that looks like a social security number to make it easier for them. Now, those folks have a number that's assigned to them. So it's easier for them to use that number sometimes to get a driver's license and things like that. But there's really no benefits tied to the back of it. And it's fascinating to me that our government that on one hand says we don't want people working unlawfully really does two things. They turn a blind eye to unauthorized employment because they never go after employers, and even take it a step further where they give people who they know or should know are going to work unlawfully a number to make it easier for them.
Right.
So that's what we have right now in terms of people of that 18 million, the people would really fall into one of those three classifications. And this is not a solution to our problem. This is inhumane and it doesn't make any sense, right? Even from a, from an economical standpoint. And it's something that I hope in my lifetime gets fixed. But after 20 years of seeing, you know, failed proposal after failed proposal, I have little faith that it will happen in the near future.
Wow. You said zero progress in 20 years or what? You have even said that it went backwards.
Yeah, it certainly has gone backwards. Yeah, I mean, if, again, 90% of the laws that we deal with as immigration lawyers right now were written in 1996. Right. And think about how different the world was, right? We didn't no such thing as a podcast in 1996.
We didn't even have proper internet, right?
Cell phones, earbuds.
Yeah.
I mean,
cell phones.
The list goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And we need an immigration system that is, you know, that is adaptable to the world that we're living in right now. The world we were living in 1996 is very different than it is now. And by no means does someone like me saying that we need a new immigration system mean that, oh, it should be open borders and we should let everybody come here and be legalized. That's how the other side twists it, right? They say, oh, they want immigration reform because, you know, they want to change the fabric of America and they want open borders. I don't think that's what anyone is advocating for. I'm certainly not. But again, these 18 million people are already here. And even during the Trump years, when we saw more deportations than ever before, only a fraction of that 18 million were deported or could possibly be deported because the system is so broken. So we need to stop lying to ourselves. Our politicians need to stop lying to us and to each other. And it's something that really needs to get fixed.
What really happened in 1996? What was that big change that, because you said that it was last changed in 1996, right?
Yeah, that was the big immigration reform that happened. It was under President Clinton, I believe. And again, I think that America was at a point in the 90s where obviously there was a boom from the internet and from the tech companies
It was right after the end of Cold War as
after the
well,
end of the
so
Cold War, and the economy in America started to become robust. And when the economy becomes robust, that creates jobs at every level, right? It creates high tech jobs. It creates jobs all the way down to what we call unskilled labor. And I think America found itself in a situation where there were immigrants pouring into the United States to work. And what's different about then than now is we didn't have the border security then that we do now, right? And Congress, or the United States government, recognized that there was a need to change the immigration law because at that point it had been written decades before. And they came together and passed an immigration set of laws that, on one hand, were good. They were adaptive to the times, and there were some things in there that have stood the test of time and have been positive. But by and large, they created a system of laws and policies that really don't make much sense, like the marriage thing that we talked about earlier, and created a way for the agency, which was then the INS and now the Department of Homeland Security, to have just a tremendous amount of power. And none of us recognized the level of that power until the Trump administration. I mean, that's really when we saw things, like I said, become weaponized and change. So I think 1996 was like today in the sense that people like you and I were talking about how there needed to be a change to the immigration system. I think in 1996, it was slanted a little bit towards public safety. And that's where we got some of the more strict laws. But that was at a time when Congress seemingly did more than it does did now, right? And there wasn't as much of a divide. And I think that's why they were able to get that done. And that's why I don't think we'll be able to get anything done now.
Right. Democracy itself, I mean, when the first laws were written, it was like centuries ago. And what I feel is that no political party and no president or no one in power actually does it for the betterment of mankind. Actually, democracy is fabricated in a way that the government has to work for the people, and people will have to do a lot of things to change it as well. But I also think is that America is always under the spotlight because it is the best in a lot of domain. Like you as an American has also said in the beginning of this podcast that it is the greatest country in this world. So when it comes under the spotlight, all its little flaws comes to show up. And also it is dealing a problem which no other country is dealing to this scale, that so many people want to become a citizen over here, get a green card, work over here. What do you know about how other countries are dealing with it? Is there some European countries which are dealing with it better?
Well, the one country that I have the most exposure to because of its geographic proximity to the United States is Canada. And Canada very much went in the opposite direction of the United States during the Trump administration. And, you know, the message that was sent across the world by the Trump administration is that we don't like immigrants. We don't want immigrants to be here. Well, Canada heard that and they reacted to it and they responded in a way to say, well, we do like immigrants and we do want immigrants. And by the way, we have a system to facilitate that, right? The system to facilitate it is a merit-based system, right? And at its core, that is what is so different than the United States. You can show up to Canada and say, hey, look, I want to have a better life here. From whatever part of the world you're from. And my understanding of it, and again, I'm not an expert in Canadian immigration law, but my understanding of it is they will do a totality of circumstances analysis of you. They'll look at your criminal history. They'll look at your family history. They'll look at your ties to Canada. They'll look at your, you know, ability to speak English, I think is one of the things Canada looks at. They'll look at your work history. I mean, everything.
Degrees, higher
And
studies, they make a whole point
degrees,
system. This is your points.
the whole thing, right? And That's one way of handling it. And I assume that, the book, so to speak, on whether this is the right thing or not is being written by Canada, and we'll all be able to read that book and look back on it 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now to see if it was the right thing. I'm very confident that it is. But what we can see right now, which is, a policy in which Canada has opened its arms to immigrants coming from all over the world, specifically over the last 5 years, it seems that it has benefited Canadian society and has benefited their economy. So that's the different way to do that. Now, on the one hand, yes, the United States government should be looking at something like that. On the other hand, the United States probably couldn't do something like that because if they did, the number of people waiting in line, knocking on the door to the United States would be dramatically more than it would be to Canada. So there's a balance, right? But to me, the focus should be, dealing with the 18 million or however many million people there are right now that are here, that want green cards, that we probably couldn't deport if we wanted to. And if we were able to deport them, it would take several years. We might as well find a way, an easy way to make those folks legalized. That to me is the next step, which makes the most sense.
Right. I never really paid attention towards what a big issue it is. It is a problem that needs to be solved, just like you can say that the homelessness problem needs to be solved. It's a big problem.
Sure.
This is also a big problem. And there are people like you who are passionate about it. Like, I see passion in you. I do not see a person who is pursuing it to make a living or to earn a lot of money. But I see a person who is passionate about this, knows the ins and outs, spent decades. So I'm interested to know how you got about it. Like, how did you get into this field? How did it actually start?
So I am the grandchild of immigrants that came from Italy. So I had an interest in immigration law, but I knew nothing about it. And by luck, I put in an application at a career fair when I was in college doing my undergraduate studies at a place called LaSalle University, a Catholic college in Philadelphia. And I put probably my resume, I gave it to everybody that would take it, right, at a career fair. And it turns out that I got a call. And it was with the Legacy INS, which again is now the Department of Homeland Security, for an internship. And I got the internship. And again, I really got lucky because it was great timing to get into the practice of immigration law because it was right before September 11th. And like I said, I was there on September 11th and I was there after September 11th. And wow, did immigration become a big part of the news at that point? And I was interested in immigration because I knew that my grandparents had come from Italy. And in the area that I grew up in, outside of Philadelphia, there were a lot of Italian immigrants, Mexican immigrants, some West Africans, but mostly Europeans, mostly Italians, and people that we would say were right off the boat, right? Italians that had just come to the United States, who were friends and part of my family. So I was interested in immigration, and I got this internship, and I was working hard, learning about the immigration system, and then boom, September 11th happened. And the reason that immigration became part of the national dialogue with immigration is that, some of the individuals that were responsible for flying the planes into the World Trade Center were here with student visas that had expired. So the question was, well, why are these people here? How come we didn't deport them? Why did this happen? And so all of a sudden, I'm learning about immigration because it's familiar to me. Now it is the national discussion, and I'm working at the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So it was a fascinating time. Well, what happened after that is the U.S. government, very much viewed the world and our laws and our administrative agencies from the standpoint of us being at war, right? We were scared it was going to happen again. We didn't know where the attack had come from and where it was coordinated. So the government went through a program that was called NSEERS. It was a National Security Registration Program where if you were from certain countries, predominantly Muslim countries, you had to appear at an immigration office to be interviewed by an officer to see what kind of ties you had to terrorism.
Oh,
So
you're
all of a
already in
sudden,
America. You have to go for an
you're
interview?
already here. Yep, you had a
Wow.
certain period of time that you had to show up to be interviewed. So Ashish, every day I would show up to work at my job at the Legacy Immigration and Naturalization Service, and there would be lines of hundreds of people around the building, every day waiting to be interviewed. So, your question in terms of how I got into immigration is I got into it by luck, having been called for this internship, which turned into a job. But I was there during this fascinating shift, right? Where I was
A
going in
monumental time, yeah.
monumental time. And, at the end of I was graduating college at the time, but the job was also expiring. And then at that point, I decided to go to law school. And I thought with going to law school that it would make sense to focus on immigration law because I had this unbelievable opportunity to see the old system turn into the new system overnight, right? And I got to see the panic and the fear on people's faces as they waited for hours a day in the pouring rain to be interviewed by an immigration agent who was looking to see if they were involved in terrorism, right? And I also got to see it from the standpoint of the agents whose job that was, right? And that was an important job to really try to figure out where these terrorism cells came from in the United States that led to September 11th. So I was,
How long were they interviewed?
oh,
Like,
some
how
people
long were
were
they
interviewed
interviewed?
multiple times for multiple hours, and some people were interviewed for, 20 or 30 minutes where they brought them in, they collected their biometrics photo, got their fingerprints and got an address on them and created a profile. And took some notes about, who they were living with, where their parents live, just a general profile. But obviously, the ones that they were concerned about, some were detained, some were that started the deportation process for some individuals. Some, like I said, were questioned for a long period of time and ended up becoming informants for the government. So, I mean, they did take in and process a tremendous amount of information in doing these interviews.
Now, I'm asking some questions because this is really shocking to me. I did not know about this. I do not know about if you know about this movie, My Name is Khan. It is by Shah Rukh Khan. It is made on that 9/11 tragedy, what happens to what was happening to Muslims at that particular time. But what was it like? Is this interview only for Muslims at that time?
It was a national security registration system where the US government basically picked the countries and said, if you are a citizen of this country, you need to go through this national security registration. And it was only
Oh,
Muslim countries.
even if you are a citizen, even
No,
if you are a
it wasn't
citizen,
if you
you
were a
need to.
citizen. It
Oh, okay.
was,
Oh,
yeah,
if you
basically, if
wasn't,
you were
right.
from these certain countries and you lacked citizenship. And I think it even was if you lacked a green card. I can't quite remember if green card holders were exempt. I believe that they
Okay.
were. But again, in big cities like Philadelphia, it resulted in, thousands and thousands of people being interviewed over that period of time for intelligence information.
Okay. Is that when you went to University of Dayton School of Law?
So that was before that. So I
Oh,
started
okay.
the University of Dayton School of Law in 2003. This had happened in 2001, right? So I was, and the NSEERS registration that we're talking about was very heavily going on prior to me going to law school, but it continued for several years even after I was in law school. So I'd worked for the
All right.
INS. I went to law school. Then when I came out of law school, I got my first job in private practice. At a law firm called Bhagia and Associates. I worked with a gentleman named Jay Bhagia, who was the premier immigration lawyer in Philadelphia at that time, and learned from him, how to be an immigration lawyer, how to advocate for people, and how to be a professional. And that was my first foray into the side of immigration that I'm on now. And I've never looked back in terms of going back and working for the government. Although I've kept many of the relationships that I have from my time at the government, and certainly some of the lessons and the knowledge in terms of how the government agencies work and the mindset that they have, I think has been valuable to me in my career.
And then somewhere around 2012, you started to work towards your own firm. What was it like? Were there like turmoils, ups and downs in your career at that time as well? A new firm?
Well, so what had happened at that point, I had started practicing law at the end of 2006. And by 2012, I started to have a following of my own clients, right? People that were calling for me, that wanted me to advise them, that wanted me to represent their family or to represent themselves. And at that time, I was still working for the same law firm called Doggy and Associates. You know, prior to that, working for that law firm, my job was to work on cases that were brought into the firm, right? And the firm remained very busy. There were cases that were coming in, but I couldn't focus on those cases because I had new cases coming in that wanted just for me to work on them. So it was the right time for me to go out on my own to create a law firm so that I could focus on building my own practice of individuals that wanted me to represent them. And I was lucky that when I started that in 2012, I had a very big following, and I was able to hit the ground running and be extremely busy. It's grown every year since then. Some years it grew exponentially, like during the Trump administration. You know, what happened during the Trump administration was, number one, you know, the people that were here that were not green card holders or US citizens said, whoa, I need to talk to an immigration lawyer because I'm worried they're going to come and arrest me.
Oh.
So the amount of people that needed the services of an immigration lawyer skyrocketed. What also happened is, you know, when the Trump administration started arresting people and they started to basically just do things that were illegal, like arrest green card holders at the airport, they did things in order to send a message. What that did is many immigration practitioners that had thought about retiring in the next year, retiring or slowing down, said, this is way too much stress for me. I'm out. Right. So the number of cases skyrocketed, the number of lawyers went down. So we got very, very busy at that time. And every year that I've done this, with the exception of the year of the pandemic, my practice has grown. And that's really without trying to grow it. And I think really that's the byproduct of the geographical area that we are in Philadelphia and the greater Philadelphia area. We've grown with the city. People want to be in Philadelphia. There's the best hospitals and universities in the world in Philadelphia. There's jobs. There's a vibrant economy. There's kind and you know, welcoming people in Philadelphia. So immigrants are still wanting to come to Philadelphia.
Right.
And here we are in a position to be able to help people. My transition into my own law firm maybe was different than some others because I didn't have to go through the growing pains of getting clients.
Right.
I had to go through the growing pains of learning how to deal
manage
with
it.
Those clients,
right.
Manage it, right? And manage my own life. And that the bigger challenge to me was in 2014 when my first child was born, was learning how to manage, you know, the time that I would have to find to be a dad and to be a husband and time for myself while also, you know, working to be a tremendous advocate for my clients. Because prior to that, I was working all the time. There was nothing that was stopping me from working because I didn't feel like I was missing anything. I didn't feel like I missed anything by not, you know, watching a series on Netflix or missing a basketball game. I put my mind and energy towards work. But naturally, that had to change. And that, for me, was the biggest challenge. Not so much creating the practice, but adapting to the practice. And I'm still trying to adapt to it and hopefully doing a decent job.
You're trying, but I think that I and the audience is trying harder. I think we can learn a few things from you. Do you have any tips for us when it comes to managing, especially work? Because you're very passionate. I'm sure you work hard, but also I think you must have found some work-life balance because you have a family. How do you do it?
Yeah, so for me, the one kind of competitive advantage that I think that I've been able to create for myself, or tool, I should say, is getting up early in the morning. So I'm up at 5 o'clock or 4:45 just about every day. And I use that time to do things that require me you know, to think. I do a lot of my legal reading of cases. I do a lot of my trial preparation. I do a lot of writing. I do a lot of my office management stuff during that time frame, right? So from 5 to 7 in the morning, there's no one that needs me. No one is angry that I'm not there, right? Which is very different than let's say 5 p.m. 5 p.m., the folks that have called me or emailed me that day are now wanting to hear back from me. It's the end of the day. How come we haven't heard back from you? My wife and kids want me to be home. My body needs a break from working all day, mm-hmm. right? But from 5 to 7, that's the period of time where if I can be productive, right? I can set my day up in the right way and I can get more things done than I would during any other 2 hour period of the day. So that's not something that came easy to me. I wasn't, you know, in high school or college waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning. It was the opposite.
Try doing that in college, right?
Right. It was the opposite. But I mm-hmm. forced myself to do it because there really mm-hmm. was no other way. So the way that it works for me is I'm up very early. And then when the day's over, the day is over, right? So when I'm finished meeting with clients for the day, I drive home, I finish my phone calls in the car. And then when I walk in through the door, that's it. The day's over. I rarely do work once I set foot back into my house to, you know, give my kids baths and things along those lines. And part of it is because I know that I have a period of time, I have a cushion the next day in order to catch up. And that's that 5 to 7 in the morning, right? So whatever I missed the day prior, I can get that done. And if it's something I can't get done, like a phone call, then I can find a time in my schedule later on that day to do it. So that for me has been the way to utilize it. And I very frequently keep up with that on the weekends. Not every weekend day, but for example, this weekend, this is a 3-day weekend. Saturday, I was mm-hmm. up at 5. I probably started at 7 o'clock Saturday morning and was able to, you know, work most of the day in order to keep up and to stay afloat. Now, there's a couple reasons for that. One is I was on vacation a couple weeks ago with my family in Italy. I was able to get away for a week and decompress. Well, now I have to, you know, have to catch up on that. So spending that Saturday working for me wasn't, I didn't feel bad about it because I had the week off. The other thing is that I, you know, can plan around things in order to make sure that I'm not missing anything. Mm-hmm. So for example, if one of my kids had a soccer game on Saturday, then I would have done it on Sunday instead of Saturday. Mm-hmm. So I'm constantly planning things in order to make sure that I'm not missing anything, but also to make sure that I'm tying up loose ends from mm-hmm. the day before or the week before and planning ahead for the week ahead. So it's a tremendous amount of energy just to stay organized and just to stay focused on the things that are truly pressing you know, at any given moment.
Right. That work ethic is pretty inspirational. You wake up at 5 o'clock even on weekends. Yeah. But do you also take care of your, let us say, diet, your health and workout? How do you do it? Because you seem very fit.
Yeah. So I'm wearing a tight shirt, so it may make me look more fit than I actually am. But yeah, so 2 days a week, I work out with a trainer at 5:30 in the morning. And then one other day a week, I try to do cardio work on the Peloton that I have. So I do that, and that's just enough for me. That 3 days a week is good enough for me. I feel good. And I can push myself to get better. The eating well is probably the biggest challenge that I have because I'm always on the run. So I've turned to some meal services. There's a meal service that's called Factor 75, where basically they deliver you meals that are good for 1 week. You refrigerate them and then you can microwave them. And they're healthy meals. You can track your calories. Mm-hmm. So I do that a couple days a week for either lunch or dinner. So it's very good when I'm, you know, coming back from court and I have clients that are waiting for me. I can spend 15 minutes in total eating a healthy meal and starting to digest it, as opposed to, you know, spending 15 minutes walking from my building somewhere, waiting for food, bringing it back. So I've learned to become efficient mm-hmm. as it relates to food, but that's certainly an area where I need to get better. No doubt about it.
Right. Thanks a lot for sharing, taking some notes. Also, when you said that, after 2012, it was an easy transition because you had so many clients and during the Trump administration, agreed. But I also feel that you always have more which you will have to manage is because you are a great person and you deal with your clients very well. After talking to you for, it has been an hour, and I've talked to your clients as well. There's some X factor I can't even really point towards. Maybe you know it better, but there's some factor that makes me feel like I want you to represent me, something like that.
I appreciate you saying that. People have asked me that before. So I've spent time thinking about that, and I think the answer is very, very simple. And that is that you know, I try to respond to people and to talk with people in a real way, right? Without using big words, without using technical terms. Yeah. And, you know, in a way to really make people understand what they're up against. And to also understand that no matter what they do, there's some things that they're just not going to be successful in. And I think that's what we do a lot as immigration lawyers. We're telling people no. And there's different ways to tell people no, right? This isn't going to work for you. One way is to say, listen, this isn't going to work for you. If you don't believe me, go talk to someone else, right? Or you could say, listen, this isn't going to work for you. And I'm telling you because I'm the smartest person. I know everything you need to listen to me. But I think the right way is to tell them no and to let them know that you're with them, that it doesn't make any sense. That you can see and you can, or me, I can feel the frustration, right? Because if they know that you're coming from that place, then I think it makes it easier for someone to trust what you're telling them, right? And the thing that I'm trying to convey to people is I want things to work out for them. And that goes back to the overall mindset that we talked about from the beginning, right? I want it to work out because I love America. America needs the immigrants. I want it to work out for the immigrants because I think it's fair for them. I think it's better for their families. And I think it's better for America if they become legalized. From my standpoint, I want it to work out for them because I want to win the case. Of course, I want every case that I'm involved in to win. And the final thing is, I want it to work out for them. And this is from a selfish standpoint, quickly, because, you know, when I agree to go down the journey with someone, sometimes these journeys last 10 or 15 years, right?
Yeah.
It's better for me. This is purely selfish.
That's your life
someone
too,
Someone
right?
becomes legal in 3 years, right? Mm-hmm. What would you rather have? It take 3 years or take 12 years? Of course you'd rather it take 3 years. It makes it easier for me. Maybe if all of the cases, if the immigration system becomes fixed, right? And all of these cases, instead of taking years and having all of these problems become easier, maybe I could start waking up at 7 a.m., right? But right now, there's so much energy and work that goes into the problem that is our immigration system. So back to your question, you know, I try to convey that to people, right? That if it is a no, or if there's a roadblock, or if it is a delay, that I understand and I feel the same stress and same anger that they have towards the process. But that there's no other way.
Right. I mean, this is really, really inspirational. What I feel is that what keeps you up 5 o'clock in the morning, what brings the work ethic, is really that you're working for something bigger than you. And I think a lot of people can learn from that. And especially people who are in 20s, sometimes in teenage, the whole world revolves around them. It's me, me, me. And I'm sure that at some point of your life, you must have gone through those phases as well. But you are a lot more mature now. And I guess that we can learn from that. That is very important. And you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say that for me, it's not even a choice, right? Because I've put myself in a position where, you know, I'm very lucky to every single day have people that want my opinion or want my help with something, that the only way for me to be able to help those people is to make sure that I'm staying organized and that I am, I'm investing in my business to have the best staff. So to me, it's never even been a choice in terms of whether to do it this way. It's just been an adaptation because the demand has always been there. But I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, it's challenging, but on the few days, you know, when things are quiet, like the week between Christmas and New Year's is usually a quiet week. I find myself yearning for, you know, for the demand to be back, yearning for, you know, the need to respond to emails, yearning for the need to make calls. So even though I haven't really had a choice, I've been forced into this by the demand that's been placed on me by, you know, having many clients. I also wouldn't want it any other way.
Ricky, thanks a lot for being over here, sharing so openly, sharing so many different aspects, talking freely and openly. It was really, really great. It means a lot. And I'm sure that the audience learned a lot. If you ever want something to share, you reach out to me. I would
Sure.
definitely love for you to be over here again. Maybe we can cover other topics as well. It was really great. I had a good
Ashish,
time.
thank you so much for having me. This was a great time, and I would love to do it again. So let's make that happen.
All right. Thank you so much, audience, to you as well. I hope you had a good time. Art is a weekly podcast. We do another podcast in Hindi that is Momentum. That is on our second channel. The links will be down in the description box. We'll see all of you in the next one. Till then, bye. That's it, Ricky. That's
All
where we
right.
cut it out. Yeah.
Wishing you a wonderful Monday, a wonderful Memorial Day. Hopefully you have something planned. Today I am not going to work anymore. This is the end of it for me.
That's
So
good.
I enjoy myself with my
That's
family, and
good.
I thanks so much for doing this. This was great.